You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Insight Cricket. 3 days have gone now in the Sydney Test match, and actually it was a better day for England, really, although it didn't start well. And a bruising day in many ways too. A day where I suppose you'd expect the Australian fast bowlers to pose problems. They did. You'd expect the English batsmen to take blows on this slightly uneven pitch. And they did. But they came out fighting England and came out with some pride, I think. Would you say, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, it was an encouraging day for England. Fantastic from Johnny Bairstow. Excellent from Ben Stokes. And one of those rumbustious late order innings from Mark Wood, depositing Pat Cummins three times into the Barongo stand for six. Now, it was thrilling cricket while it lasted. And then, of course, you know, to top it off, Johnny Bairstow, was he going to get his 100 in the last over before the close? A bit like Steve Waugh in a Sydney Test match, you know, way back when he got 100 off Richard Dawson in the final over of the day. And Australia had this tactic. They bowled wide of off stump with a strong offside field, 70 offside field. He missed a couple and then eventually scythed one away down towards deep third. And, you know, just a release of joy for Johnny Bairstow. Inevitably, yeah, an Ashes 100, especially away from home. You know, it's a wonderful feeling. Second Ashes 100, he still ran towards the pavilion. He was halfway back towards the pavilion to celebrate. And his teammates, you know, were happy for him as well. And England's first 100 of the series. And that's been the problem, hasn't it? The first 100 of the series has come in the fourth test.
Yeah. And it was his first 50 for a long time as well, actually, Bairstow, wasn't it? Because he's continually got the 20s and 30s and never been able to get a substantial score. Do you know, it's almost exactly 5 years to the day when he scored his first Test 100 at Cape Town, in partnership, of course, with Ben Stokes. 258 Stokes made in that case. And I think they put on almost 400, actually, against South Africa. It was something like the 5th of January 2016. So, and that was a momentous day for Bairstow, particularly. Cape Town, a special place for him and his family. His father spent a lot of time playing out in South Africa, and his mother was there on the day when he got his first Test 100. It was a big 100 as well, 150. And you felt then he'd sort of broken through. And it's funny, but sort of since then, partly because of his involvement in the England One Day side, a tremendously successful participation in that, opening the batting against the white ball, that's compromised slightly his progress in Test cricket. And so this has been, I think, it's his seventh Test 100, but you would have expected him to have probably added more than that in the time. Stokes has got 10 Test 100s. And in a way, Bairstow's no lesser player, but, you know, because of the compromising of playing one-day cricket, also keeping wicket, being in and out of the team a bit, he hasn't quite progressed as perhaps he would have hoped.
Yeah, and up and down the order as well. You know, I've said this many times before. I thought Bairstow keeping wicket and batting, you know, seven was working, but they wanted something different. They wanted more from Johnny Bairstow because they thought he was a more talented batter than a number seven. They gradually pushed him up the order, you know, with the wicket-keeping gloves on, and then they took the wicket-keeping gloves off him and made him bat, you know, at the higher up the order, and that didn't work. And yeah, they sort of changed something that was working because other parts of the team weren't working, and they felt that he was one of the players that could fix it. But today you just had one of those glorious days. I was there in Cape Town that day.
I mean,
The most amazing clobbering I think I've ever seen in Test cricket. They put on 399. I mean, Bairstow obviously played his part, but I mean, Ben Stokes was just, I mean, it was a shot of ball almost. An incredible day anyway. And it wasn't so incredible today, but it was a really valiant century partnership. I have to say, at lunchtime, when England were 36 before and Milan was caught down the leg side, I started to think, this game could end today. England could easily be rolled out for 100. Australia on a pitch like that, do they want to bat again with the ball, you know, going up and hitting gloves and things like that? You know, they might get a broken finger or a broken hand. Why not just enforce the follow-on, you know, lead a 300, let's say, if England had been rolled out for 100. So for England to be in the position they are at the close of play is actually sort of a minor cricketing miracle, to be honest, especially in the context of what we've seen so far in the series. One thing I would say, though, bottom line, Australia's still in control of this Test match. As long as the weather behaves itself in the next couple of days, they're still in a very good position. Unless, of course, Bairstow can thrive with the tail tomorrow. They probably need to score another 70, 90 runs, something like that, to sort of drag Australia back and make it harder for them to get at that really big lead. But, you know, Australia's still in a pretty good position in this Test match, and you'd back them to causing them some problems on the final day.
Well, you would, and they've just got more potency with the ball. I was very impressed, actually, in the way Scott Boland bowled today, only his second Test. And, you know, the man who was picked at the MCG, a sort of horses for courses, home territory and all that, because he took an incredible 6 for 7, and that was sort of beginner's luck in a way. But, you know, this game, today, he bowled immaculately, I thought, in his first 5 or 6 overs, and showed what can happen on this pitch if you just jag away at a decent length and the ball just darting this way and that and lifting off a length as well quite awkwardly. Cummins and Stark clearly posing problems, and then of course you've got Cameron Green as well to get the ball to lift alarmingly. In his first 4 overs, he didn't concede a run. So, you know, they really have got the armoury, Australia, for this pitch. I mean, it started so badly for England, didn't it? And, you know, wasn't it interesting to watch Haseeb Hameed batting today? Obviously demanding conditions, high class bowling, an awkward pitch, but he bore out a lot of what Nick Compton was saying in the Virtual Cricket Club the day before. If you listen to our podcast after the second day's play, we've got some extracts from Nick Compton's interview, and he talks quite strongly about Haseeb Hameed's technique and how it's just not up to the standard required to negotiate this kind of bowling. His arms are away from his body. He can't get his head and his balance forward into the shot when necessary, and, you know, totally exposed today. A good ball from Stark, swung in a little bit, but, you know, just a massive gate between bat and pad, and the bat way ahead of the body, and just a hopeless attempt to combat a good delivery. You know, you've been saying all along, yes, there are going to be good deliveries bowled in this series, but you've got to be able, as a Test player, you've got to be able to survive some good deliveries, and particularly Hameed, and to a lesser extent Crawley, and not appeared to be capable of doing that. Crawley out also, big booming drive to Scott Boland, a ball which wasn't a half volley and nipped back through the gate. Again, a good ball, but could have been better negotiated with a more sensible shot. So, you know, again, we've got these issues of technique about top order England players looking horribly deficient.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what they do for the next Test match, and B, for West Indies, the next series, where they have a, you know, complete rethink at the top of the order. I mean, they've already had so many rethinks. That's the problem. They've used so many openers. And, of course, you know, Crawley and Hamid are opening because Burns and Sibley have been dispatched. It may be, who knows, it may be that Burns comes back into the side for the next test match for the West Indies. I mean, Hamid is having a really wretched time of it. I hear a couple of 20s at the Gabba in the first game. Actually, I thought he looked reasonable, but he's never threatened to score sufficient runs in this series. I have to say, I did fear for him. And if go back to some of our back issues, I did worry about his ability to score in Australia. And, it's another single-figure score from him, 5 single-figure scores in a row. And what do they do now? Do they just say, well, it's not working? He's got one more innings, of course, in the second innings, if something might come of that. But, the way he's going, you wouldn't say that's necessarily going to be the case. And I actually agree with Nick Compton. This idea that were the weight of runs there that sort of demanded Hamid be picked and come back in the side. I mean, I was in India and it was a hugely promising start to his test career 4 or 5 years ago. But, he's had that dip and he's come back and he has done well, but was it right to pick him now? Well, they've thrown him in a couple of half centuries against India, but a lot of low scores as well. What I would do, I think, is I would take him to definitely, he's a very good player of spin. So you want him in Asia, for example, playing against teams like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, whatever.
But India have got some of the best fast bowlers.
Well, they have. I suppose that's part of the problem.
I think this idea that you want to be, when you go to India, you need to be a good player of spin is almost a bit redundant. Now, you've got to be a good player, basically, all-round player. Listen, I'm just going to read you, by the way, if you want a clue. I mean, not that this is really rocket science, but if you want a clue as to why England have performed so badly in this series, the opening partnerships tell you the story, really. At the Gabba, opening partnership of naught. That was obviously the first ball of the series. And 23 in the second innings. Adelaide, 7-4. MCG, 4-7. And SCG, so far, 22. So only 2 of the 7 opening partnerships so far in the 20s, and none further than that, and most in single figures. That's one basic reason why England are in this terrible plight.
I agree with Hamid. There are potential problems with Hamid against Indian bowlers away from home, and of course Pakistan bowlers as well. They've got a decent pace attack as well. The only thing I would say probably is that the pitches don't bounce as much in India and Pakistan as they do in Australia. So you might think that he might be able to get through against the pacers in those countries. And then clearly he is a good player of spin, but it's a work in progress.
And I would just, as I said yesterday about for young England bowlers or even experienced England bowlers, watching how someone like Stuart Broad or James Anderson approaches an over and how they manipulate a batsman around the crease, I would also say every batsman in the world should watch just the first 2 overs of Root's innings today. I know Root got a duck and... okay, that can happen. He got a goodish ball. It probably wasn't a great shot early in his innings. Very good catch by Steve Smith as well. But I just thought it was interesting watching Root defend his first 10 deliveries after Crawley got out, playing a booming drive at a length ball, sort of stiff front leg and bat miles out in front of the pad, ball getting through the gate. Good ball, but, still poor technique. And I just watched Root play the same bowler and the same sort of balls just after that, about 8 or 9 of them. Scott Boland attacking the stumps, a little bit of nip back in from just outside off stump, a good length. And Root on the crease, playing it as late as possible, alongside the ball, not trying to drive it, just allowing the ball to come to him and playing it with a nice soft hands and a dead bat. And watching the ball right onto the bat all the way. And rather than seeking some kind of expansive drive early on. I know Root failed today, but his technical excellence needs a lot more marketing, if you like, promotion, exhibition, to show this is how you play in Test cricket. Because it's a masterclass, even though he got naught today. Actually, those first balls he faced today was exactly how you need to play. And not enough other England batsmen are able to do that.
Scott Bowler bowled a really tight line actually to him, but the ball that got him out, he bowled a bit wider. And I don't know whether Root thought, well, this is a four ball, didn't he? I think that was the point. And he sort of played a sort of flick stroke at it, rather than a horizontal back cut shot. It was like a sort of flick straight back stroke, and he nicked it to Smith, and Smith took a really good catch. So perhaps don't show them the way Root was out. Because they all get out.
There are so many
that.
Other examples in this series of the excellence of Root's technique. So today was one to miss out on.
Yeah, I accept what you're saying about the early balls, but not necessarily the one that dismissed him.
I suppose my point was that it was the same bowler who just got Crawley out playing the wrong way, and Root demonstrated how to play those balls the right way. That's all.
Yeah. And then soon after Root was out, Milan, just sort of emphasising the tricky nature of this pitch, especially, perhaps in the first 30, 40 overs when the ball's a bit harder. He got wrapped on the gloves twice by Cameron Green. People say, well, why weren't England's bowlers able to exploit this? Well, they're not perhaps as tall and not generally as quick. I mean, Broad's obviously tall, but he's not as quick as, Cummins and Stark and Green. And so, Milan taking on the glove twice, and then at little edge down the leg side, a ball that was about glove height, and they had that leg slip in. And, it worked for Australia. England employed the leg slip a lot in this series. Australia went with it, and Khawaja took the catch. So 36 for four, it was all over. It was going to be a procession. And then superb partnership between Stokes and Bairstow, but a really bizarre passage of play either side of lunch. England went, it's incredible, really. Sometimes this happens, when you're blocking out for a draw on the final day, but 70 balls without scoring either side of lunch. It's a remarkable statistic, and the roar went up when Stokes played one back of a square for a single on the offside. But once they got going, actually they played really fluently, and Bairstow's innings and Stokes, tremendous sort of counter-attacking batsmanship.
And you'd think what could have happened, what they could have done, if, say, England had been 100 for four instead of 30 for four, just if those openers could get a little bit further into the innings and protect the middle order more, then, Stokes and Bairstow could have, it wasn't the pitch to put on 399 like at Cape Town, but they could at least have put on 150, maybe even 200. And bowlers get dispirited and the ball goes soft and the fielding isn't quite as keen. Men are scattered rather than slips and short legs and so on. And it's amazing how momentum can change. I thought Stokes played really well. He moved around the crease. He came up the pitch a bit to Boland at times to try and put him off his length. You do have to do that, I think, when you've got a bowler like that. He took on the short ball occasionally. He obviously is in quite a lot of pain. And so you're probably right. This is his last hurrah, really, of this series. And actually, Bairstow, also pugnacious. I thought he played the spin really well. He didn't allow Nathan Lyon to dictate at all. Swept him and sort of bunted him over deep mid-wicket and got off for the back foot and hit him through the offside, forced Lyon to go round the wicket, then forced him to go back over the wicket, didn't allow him to build up any pressure. And it just put the pressure back on Australia a bit. And it was a shame when that partnership ended, really. There was that funny one also. A little bit of luck for England. There was that strange one where Stokes left it and the ball cannoned into the stump and didn't take the bails off. And then he was given out LBW. Weirdly, and then obviously on review, everyone realised what had actually happened. So, I think it was an impressive effort by two of the sort of doughty, experienced campaigners in the England team, showing what fight and a bit of belligerence can do.
I think three things happened today that haven't happened before in this series. One is that Australia missed chances. They dropped three catches, and England had a bit of luck as well. You mentioned that one where Stokes was bowled in inverted commas and the ball hit the top of the off stump. Australia dropped three catches. Stokes was one of them, actually. A caught and bowled chance to Cummins when he'd made nine. Carey dropped one diving away to his right-hand side. Harris, short leg. That would actually have been a superb catch if Harris had taken Crawley away to the right-hand side. Those early ones didn't actually matter that much. The Cummins one did. It's one of those that sometimes sticks, sometimes doesn't as a caught and bowled chance. But it was two hands straight back at him. So Australia dropped catches. The other thing that happened today that hasn't happened so far in the series is that England were able to get on top of Nathan Lyon. And it just shows how you can put the pressure back on a team if you can disrupt Lyon, actually, because he's their controller, it seems to me. You know, they've got the attackers with the pace bowlers, but he's their controller. Okay, he does attack in the second innings and he does pick up wickets in the first innings. But Lyon today, he'd gone at 2.1 runs per over in the series, but today, 12 overs, one for 71. Actually, it's quite a key moment and a big moment when he pinned Stokes LBW. And the third thing that happened today is that Australia lost a bowler because Scott Boland was off the field for pretty much the whole of the final session. He couldn't bowl in the last session. So that puts pressure back on the opposition as well. England had to deal with that on the second day when Stokes went in the side. You're right, it was like casualty ward X today. Boland got an injury, Stokes playing with injury, Bairstow wrapped on the glove, and nasty one. He's going to have an X-ray to see what the situation is, see what sort of damage was done by that snorting delivery. But he actually battled through. I think he was on 61 when he was hit, but he battled through and a fine 100.
I was in my father's old study last week. He passed away 4 years ago, but the room is still full of all his team sheets and address lists and other paraphernalia connected to running Colts teams at Ealing Cricket Club. He spent most of his evenings on the phone trying to book pitches and assemble junior teams and persuade parents to help with transport. There were constant dropouts and excuses and other issues. It was a right old headache. What he would have given for Spond. Spond is an app that is perfect for sports coaches, enabling smooth communication between team organisers, coaches, players and guardians. It's easy to use and totally secure. Spond works across any device and even allows you to share files, schedules, manage single or multiple events, make payments and send group and private messages. It even syncs with your calendar. And it's free. 500,000 coaches already subscribe to it. Spond takes the hard work out of teamwork. My dad would have loved it. Go to www.spond.com.
Here's a question for you then, Yoz. Butler came in out for naught today. What do they do with Josh Butler? What do they do with Johnny Bairstow? Do they give the wicket-keeping gloves back to Johnny Bairstow? And is Josh Butler sort of coming naturally to the end of his test match career and focus on white ball cricket? Where do you see it? Or is that just a sort of knee-jerk reaction to a disappointing series played under sort of COVID restrictions and players being in the bubble and away for a long time and it's an unnatural situation? Can they afford to just jettison a player like Josh Butler like that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I mean, one has to be very sensitive about looking at this situation, because if you are setting up a sort of, if you like, duel between Butler and Bairstow for who keeps the gloves, who's the wicketkeeper batsman going forwards, and obviously Ben Folkes will be in that equation as well.
Yeah,
they're two very different men, Bairstow and Butler, both obviously tremendous cricketers and workers and fitness addicts and so on, and they're also very, very good white ball cricketers. We all know that. I think that the difference between them partly is that Josh Butler now has two children and has a very happy family life in Clapham in southwest London. And I've seen him with his wife, and when they only had one child in the summer, their daughter. And there's this sort of happiness about it. There's a real contentment when you can see it. In his family. And I'm not saying that other members of the team are not also happy with their families, but there's just obviously a draw for Joss towards his sort of family and his life, at home domestically. I think he loves all that. Johnny Bairstow is not married and doesn't have kids. And I think when you have kids, it does change your perception. Not everybody, but I think as a professional cricketer particularly, when you start having children and you see the you become much more paternal and often involved in your family, I think it can change your perception on your professional life as a sportsman. And I just sort of feel that Joss is drawn more towards the bosom of the family than perhaps some players. And that's very difficult to manage when you're, or rather, you know, being in bubbles like they've been for so long. You know, in his case, playing in the World T20 and playing in the IPL and obviously now in Australia, it's really tough. And I can sort of see it in his face that he's just finding the going really grueling. It sounds a sort of weak excuse for not playing well in Test cricket, but, you know, these emotional things are powerful and have a big effect on you. And I just feel that it may be that the time has come to say that, like Moeen Ali, who has pulled out of Test cricket because he just couldn't handle the endless tours, and again, a family man, very close to his kids. I just wonder whether Butler will come to a conclusion that, look, I just can't do this anymore. I want to do white ball cricket. I want to play in the franchise cricket. That's maybe where my best skills lie, and not do these long Test match tours. And, you know, what is it, 96 runs in 7 innings in this series? A few drop catches. I mean, no lack of commitment, no lack of attention to detail and focus, but it's just not happening, is it? And, you know, then that may be a contributory factor.
Yeah, and that may well happen, and we'll find out fairly soon, because the England selectors will have to pick a squad to go to the West Indies, and there'll be lots of interest, you know, in who is in and who's out in that party. So if it's not to be Joss Butler, is it going to be Johnny Bairstow with the gloves, do you think, or is it going to be Ben Foulkes? Do England need a sort of total reset and say, actually, Bairstow bat 5-6, whatever, and Foulkes keep wicket, or do they go back to Johnny Bairstow with the gloves? Does that seem a bit too retro?
No, I don't think it does. I remember, actually, when Johnny Bairstow brought his book out, his book about his life, autobiography, well it was a book actually written by Duncan Hamilton, a sort of biography, really. And I talked to him on the day we actually presented that to an audience at Headingley, and I said, what's your aim? This is about 3 or 4 years ago now. And so, what's your target, you know? And he said, I want to be the first player to play 100 tests for England as a keeper batsman. And at the time, he'd played, I don't know, 35 tests as wicketkeeper batsman. He's probably played maybe about 50 or something like that. But he desperately wants to be the wicketkeeper batsman for the England test team. I'm pretty sure of that. And so why not? He's a very good keeper. There's not much to choose with him and Butler. You know, they both had their great days and lesser days. But it's a question of whether he thinks he can handle it, where they want him to bat. If he's going to bat in the top six, he probably shouldn't be the keeper. If he's going to bat at 7, he could be.
He's played 80 test matches, Johnny Bairstow. As you say, it was his 700th today, his second in Ashes cricket, both those away from home, one in Perth and one at the SCG. And it was a glorious counter-attacking innings. And one of the other features of England's batting today, the batting of Stokes and the batting of Bairstow, and also another player who took the spotlight for a short while today, but a really important stand with Johnny Bairstow was Mark Wood. And Mark Wood today did something that no other player has done in Pat Cummins' international career, and that is hit Cummins for 3 sixes in an innings. So Mark Wood, there's a little thumbs up to him, depositing Cummins 3 times into the Brongle stand. It was magnificent. It reminded me a little bit of Darren Goff when he played, scored a runnable 50 at the SCG back in 94-5. That's rolling back the years. But there was an ebullience to Wood's batting, and it sort of characterised England's fight back today. But overall, how's this game going to play out, do you think, Yoz, in conclusion? Australia still have a 150-odd run leading, have 3 wickets left. There's still 2 days left in the Test match. The pitch is it's a bit up. It's not so much down at the moment, but it's a bit up. Where's it heading, do you think?
Good point about Mark Wood, by the way. There's a joy and fun about his batting, which I really like. And actually, no lack of ability either. Clearly, he's already made a Test 50. And I saw him actually, again, filming this documentary last year, and watching him batting in the nets at Ashington, his home club, and he really does take his batting seriously, and he's got talent. And in fact, as a young man, as a sort of teenager, he was a very good batsman whose bowling sort of developed almost quite late in a way. Where's this game going? Well, I mean, England are going to concede a lead of 100, probably a bit more. That's a massive lead on this pitch. It's a pitch which is only going to get worse. Obviously, England also don't have Stokes to bowl, so they're going to be a man down in the bowling attack. So I can see Australia rattling up 200 for 7 or something, maybe a bit more, 240 for 8, something like that, and setting England 350, 360 to win, and they'll get rolled. That's how I see it. How do you see it?
Yeah, I'm pretty similar, I think. Yeah, I think that Australia's lead will be big enough for them to press on. I suppose the thing for England is to get as close as they can to Australia's total, make them bat for as long as possible, and then try to hold on the final day. And they'll also hope to have a bit of, you know, weather assistance as well. I can tell you that Kent wicketkeeper batsman Sam Billings has been added to the England squad as cover. He's out here playing in the Big Bash. And what I'm thinking about there, well, Bairstow took a blow on the glove today, and Butler took a blow on the back of the hand yesterday. So it may be, you know, we saw Josh Butler come out today, get naught. It may be that Butler's got an issue with his left hand. You know, there may be who knows? There may be a break there. We don't know. Bairstow's having an X-ray. Obviously, there's a bit of an issue there in terms of keeping wicket in the short term. Ollie Pope was off to the nets today to do some wicket-keeping practice, and now Sam Billings has been added to the squad with one test match to go in Hobart.
That's interesting. So, you know, Sam Billings has been having a great time with Sydney Thunder in the Big Bash. And when we were talking at the end of last year about England's sort of test match prospect and who could come in, who could change their horrible run of defeats and poor performances of late. Is there another player out there who hasn't yet played for England? And I think Billings is one. And, you know, he hasn't got an incredible first-class record, but he's decent. He's made hundreds at first-class level. He's batted in the top four for Kent. He's one of those multi-talented cricketers, or even sportsmen, who you could sort of feel could elevate his game to test level. Obviously, he's a keeper as well. I think he's someone that to keep an eye on. Ben Folkes, obviously, as well, as two potential successors to the Bairstow-Butler era, if Bairstow isn't going to carry on keeping wicket. Interesting, by the way, he's I just looked it up. He's kept wicket in 49 of his 80 test matches. So he's on the verge of getting to the half century there. So many questions for England to answer, and not many answers at the moment, sadly.
Yeah. I mean, in the short term, there are injury question marks over Butler, Bairstow, and Ben Stokes. It's funny, isn't it, how these Ashes tour happen? I mean, I remember a past tour when there, you know, so many players, I mean, well, not just one past tour, many past tours when so many players get injured. And by the fifth test, the team looks very different from the one that started in the first test. But I mean, by the sounds of it, I mean, that puts a big question mark over Butler's participation in the next test match, potentially. We don't know the full details there. And obviously Ben Stokes as well, with his side injury. You know, he's not going to recover in time for Hobart, and we wait and see what is the situation with Johnny Bairstow. But in the short term, England battled away today. They sort of regained a bit of pride. First 100 of the series. We'll see how it plays out tomorrow on the fourth day. A lot depends on the weather, but you feel there's enough time left in the game for Australia to press home their advantage. But if, you know, for once in this Test series today, the Aussies they were pushed onto the back foot, or at least they weren't on the front foot.
Okay, well, thanks for those thoughts, Simon, and let's hope for some real rearguard work from England on the fourth day. We'll be back to talk to you about that this time tomorrow. See you then.
Podcast Network.